The Pentagon reacts to Moscow's suspension of the New START nuclear treaty.
Even at the height of the Cold War, it was important for us to have strategic stability conversations with then the Soviet Union. And the same is true with Russia today. We have a special responsibility as the world's two largest nuclear powers to not let our nuclear arsenals get out of control.
Plus, just what is the Russian Navy doing off the coast of South Africa?
One of the Kremlin's warships is carrying its latest super weapon, a hypersonic cruise missile called the Zircon.
And later in the program, we go back to Bucha, the site of alleged Russian war crimes, where we find that some things can be repaired and cleaned up, others cannot. Today is Thursday, February 23rd. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. President Joe Biden has wrapped up his visit to Eastern Europe, where he paid a surprise visit to Kyiv, and in Warsaw he worked to shore up partnerships with NATO allies. As VOA's Lori London reports, while Biden was in Warsaw delivering a ringing speech on Western unity, his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin announced that Russia was suspending its participation in the last remaining U.S.-Russia nuclear arms control treaty.
Russian President Vladimir Putin, in his State of the Nation address on Tuesday, declared that Moscow is suspending its participation in the 2010 New START treaty with the United States. Dr. Colin Kahl, U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, tells VOA Putin also emphasized that Russia isn't completely withdrawing from the pact yet.
Yeah, I think technically he said he was suspending Russia's participation in as opposed to leaving the treaty. And I think that while that sounds a little lawyerly, I think he chose that phrase intentionally. I think that he probably doesn't think it's in Russia's interest, given that the country is going broke, to engage in a large-scale nuclear arms race with the United States like we saw during the Cold War. So I think saying that they're suspending their participation in New START was a way for him to seem tough while also leaving open the possibility of returning to the treaty.
Putin said Russia can't accept U.S. inspections of its nuclear sites under the pact, while Washington and its NATO allies have openly declared Russia's defeat in Ukraine as a goal. Kahl says the Biden administration is hopeful Moscow will return to the conversation.
I don't know what his intentions are. I'll just say that from the U.S. government's perspective, even at the height of the Cold War, it was important for us to have strategic stability conversations with then the Soviet Union. The same is true with Russia today. We have a special responsibility as the world's two largest nuclear powers to not let our nuclear arsenals get out of control and to never use them in a conflict. And I think, like I said, even during the darkest days of the Cold War, the Russian leadership understood the value of this.
The pact, known as New START, was already on life support following Moscow's cancellation late last year of the talks that had been intended to salvage an agreement that each side had accused the other of violating. Lori London, VOA News in Washington.
We'll check out the waters off South Africa in a few minutes. Now, Ukrainians and their supporters marched through Australia's biggest city on Thursday to mark the first anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
365 days strong was the rallying call for the march in Sydney. About 1,000 people marched through the city before holding a candlelit vigil outside the city's St. Mary's Cathedral. Rally organisers say the mood was sombre yet defiant, and that the gathering has honoured the heroic resistance of the brave Ukrainian people. Andrew Mensinski is the Vice President of the Ukrainian Council of New South Wales. He told VOA Thursday that the vigil was a time to reflect on what he called a horrific year.
There is an immense amount of trauma that people have suffered, and there is an immense amount of human loss of life that people have experienced. Almost every person who's marching today knows someone who has been injured or knows someone who has lost a loved one. And so tonight we are gathering to honour those people that have fallen.
Vigils were also held Thursday in Canberra and Melbourne. Rallies are scheduled in Brisbane and Perth on Friday. Australia is the largest non-NATO contributor to Ukraine's war effort, supplying missiles and armoured personnel carriers. Since the invasion began a year ago, Australia has imposed sanctions on hundreds of Russian politicians, including President Vladimir Putin, military commanders, and business people. They are the most sweeping penalties Australia has ever placed on another country. It's also banned the importation of Russian oil, petroleum, coal, and gas. Since February 2022, Australia has granted visas to almost 10,000 refugees fleeing the conflict in Ukraine. Australia has also committed $680,000 and three staff members to support the International Criminal Court investigation into alleged Russian war crimes. The government has condemned Russia's unilateral, illegal and immoral aggression against the people of Ukraine. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A joint naval exercise off South Africa's east coast that involves South Africa, Russia and China is underway amid concerns that Russia will test what it calls a game-changing weapon. The South African government describes the exercise as routine, despite criticism at home and abroad. Darren Taylor reports.
Russian state news agency TASS says one of the Kremlin's warships is carrying its latest superweapon, a hypersonic cruise missile called the Zircon. According to the Russian military, the missile cannot be detected by radar because it travels at more than five times the speed of sound. President Vladimir Putin has called the Zircon unstoppable, claiming its range is more than 1,000 kilometers or 620 miles. TASS reported the frigate would hold a training launch this week without mentioning the Zircon, but South Africa's Defense Department denied there'd be a missile launch. The exercise coincides with the one-year anniversary of Moscow's invasion of Ukraine on Friday. Western governments are concerned Russia's using the event as propaganda to showcase its military strength. The African National Congress, the ANC government, points to similar exercises it's held with other countries as evidence of the normalcy of its cooperation with Moscow. Maritime expert at South Africa's Institute for Security Studies, Tim Walker, says it's not a fair comparison.
Russia is a belligerent state. It is currently engaged in an international armed conflict. The previous exercises with France and the United States were not held under those kind of conditions. This is a situation...
South Africa says it maintains a neutral stance on the Ukraine conflict. It abstained from voting last year on a UN resolution condemning Russia. China and the former Soviet Union supported the ANC's struggle against apartheid, providing it with money, weapons, and military training. Many analysts agree that as much as Pretoria tries to paint its naval drills with Russia in shades of normal, the backlash that could follow would be anything but. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Securing the skies has been a primary concern in Ukraine since Russia's invasion began. And for NATO countries bordering Ukraine and Russia, it's a job that is shared. Fighter pilots from Italy, Germany, the United States, and others rotate through countries on the alliance's eastern flank to keep constant watch for any threats crossing into NATO airspace. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb caught up with members of the Italian Air Force as they practiced and trained in Romania.
An Italian Eurofighter patrols the skies near Romania's border with Ukraine. Italian Colonel Michele Morelli tells us his 150-man team arrived at this Romanian airbase for one mission.
We're basically here to protect Romanian airspace from any type of threat that might be out there.
They're part of a massive NATO-enhanced air policing operation, created in direct response to Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014.
Russia may say that this is provocative, but NATO says it's deterrence.
Well, of course it's deterrence. We are not here to fight any war.
They serve as a sort of collective shield across NATO airspace.
If somebody comes to us, they cannot just expect a single country to face that threat, but a huge organization like NATO with a lot of fighters, a lot of pilots knowing each other and be ready to protect the country.
Aircraft travel fast. An average airliner slower than a fighter jet still travels about 11 kilometers per minute. So a team of two jets are always on high alert here for potential intercepts and must be able to get airborne in less than 15 minutes. To test their speed, Morelli and the Italians scramble.
Gotta go.
It's called a T-scramble drill, a race to get cleared for takeoff and up in the air at any moment, day or night. The team makes it look easy. And now, with Russia's further aggression in Ukraine, defense analysts say pilots like Morelli have become a vital addition to NATO's eastern flank.
There's also anticipation of a Russian military offensive at some point in the coming weeks. Some already designate that this offensive may have been on the way. And so these NATO pilots are going to watch for Russian Air Force activity.
Morelli's team took just 11 minutes to take off. But he says they will be back at it in a few days, eager to race the clock again, knowing every second would count should a real threat enter NATO skies. Carla Babb, VOA News, Mihail Colganicianu Air Base, Romania.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. In just a few minutes, Anna Chernikova will bring us to Bucha, the site of alleged Russian war crimes that shocked the world. She's here now with this preview.
At the very beginning of this invasion, Kyiv region was partly occupied. And the worst thing, the biggest tragedies that happened in Kyiv region was exactly in that two cities, in Bucha and in Irpin. These are two little cities just 30 minutes drive from the city of Kyiv. And they suffered the most, well, war crimes, as now experts are putting it. And basically what we're going to see in this story is how these two cities are doing now. We're going to come back to the places where the most terrific and the most horrible events happened. We all remember when Kyiv region was liberated by Ukrainian forces, the first images that everyone saw was image of bodies, of the street full of bodies, of the street full of destroyed military equipment. And and we're going to take our trip there and see how all these places are doing now, how all the damages are looking now, because the cities were doing a very hard work to, you know, to come back to life. So, and also, of course, the most important, talking to people who witnessed it all and who made a decision either to stay and not leave at all, and to stay from the very beginning of occupation until the very end, until the liberation of these areas, and also to some people who had to evacuate and then came back and build their life, their old and new life at the same time back home.
And that story is coming up next right here on Flashpoint Ukraine. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, just as we talked about, early on in the war, Russian forces got close to Kyiv and committed some of the conflict's worst massacres in the communities of Irpin and Bucha. Anna Chernikova recently returned to the scene and has this report.
It's been nearly 1 year since the world woke up to the first images of Russian atrocities in liberated areas of the Kyiv region. We came back to Irpin and Bucha, the hardest hit places that Russia once occupied in the Kyiv region, to see what life here looks like now. Olga and Slava Ovcharenko are residents of Irpin, whom we met last April when they decided to return after being evacuated. Today, they are back to a somewhat normal life, one that has been deeply transformed.
A lot of buildings were rebuilt and many people returned. The mood is improving and we are waiting for spring. In the spring, it will be even better when nature will cover what is still ruined for now. There is no fear. There is a clear plan of action. If there will be another offensive, then we already know everything clearly. We have already survived this situation.
When we returned, there was no one there at all. And now, more or less, almost the same volumes and desire to do something.
Irpin was one of the most destroyed places in the Kyiv region. Today it is full of life, but the scars of war remain fresh. After a 10-minute drive, we enter the neighboring town of Bucha. Yablunska Street in Bucha was the scene of one of the greatest tragedies in the Kyiv region in this war. The first image that millions of people around the world saw after Ukrainian forces liberated the Kyiv region from Russian occupation in March 2022 was this spot. A long street full of dead bodies. An atrocity now known as the Bucha Massacre. Natalia Zelena lives on this street. She witnessed it all.
This is the road of death. It's terrible what was happening here. Here the body of my child's godfather was lying by the pillar, shot dead. Here dead bodies were lying as well, and here, on the road.
Volodymyr Pretko also survived the Russian occupation in Bucha.
Debris was all around here, bullet shots. It was scary to walk on the streets. On April 1, I went outside and saw our infantry fighting vehicles on their way. The soul rejoiced. People started to get outside.
Now, a year after the tragic event, people in this town continue to live and recover. One can see smiles on people's faces, but still, much pain in people's eyes. Anna Chernikova for VOA News in the Kyiv region, Ukraine.
Simon Miles is an assistant professor at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University and an expert in Russia and the former Soviet Union. He's the author of Engaging the Evil Empire. It's the story of how back channel and secret negotiations laid the groundwork for Washington and Moscow ending the Cold War. I asked him, is something like that possible now?
Of course, something like that is possible. And I think we've seen various actors try to kind of carve out that role for themselves. In the early days of the war, it was Emmanuel Macron of France who was sort of trying to become the intermediary and perhaps even the sort of interpreter between the Kremlin and the rest of the world. If news reports from today are to be believed, Xi Jinping is on his way to Moscow in the next few months to try to advance a sort of a Chinese-led diplomatic solution to the war. And even with the visit by President Biden to Kyiv very recently, we know that U.S. military and other personnel that were communicating that information to the Kremlin in order to prevent something truly dangerous and devastating from happening. So I think that sort of thing is almost always happening in international politics.
Well, I'm glad you brought up President Biden's trip to Kyiv. Was that Biden's Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall moment?
You know, I've seen it compared to Reagan in front of the Brandenburg Gate. I've seen it compared to John F. Kennedy stating "Ich bin ein Berliner." It certainly was, a powerful symbolic message. And when I say symbolic, I don't mean that to belittle the significance. Symbols matter a great deal in international politics.
Let's look back 1 year ago. Were you surprised when Putin launched his invasion? Did you see it coming?
My sense at the time in February of 2022 was that they had nowhere near the quantity of manpower and materiel massed on Ukraine's borders to try to do anything like what it seemed like they wanted, which was to totally transform the political orientation of a major country. That turned out to be the case. Now, I thought that they would just try to do something on a much smaller scale, and instead they went truly maximalist to an absurd degree in their efforts to try to change Ukraine's, you know, basically to decapitate the government. So I wasn't surprised that there was an invasion. But when I woke up and learned quite quickly about the scale of what they were trying to do, I was indeed surprised and very skeptical that they had anything approaching the requisite force posture to achieve those maximalist war aims.
So both Ukraine and Russia, neither of those countries are willing to negotiate with the other country right now. Who blinks first? How does this end?
I think that it's pretty clear from the Ukrainian political milieu right now that there's really very little appetite for negotiation with a partner that, very credibly, they would say, can't really be trusted. It's hard to imagine that Vladimir Putin is not going to repeat the behaviors of, for example, the Minsk process, which was an attempt to resolve the Russian occupation of eastern Ukraine, and use any pause in conflict just to build up for another push later on down the road. Meanwhile, in Russia, you know, it was striking if you looked at the audience for Vladimir Putin's speech, in which he gave a sort of a one-year update, the extraordinary lack of enthusiasm in that room. His cabinet, his top advisors looking just absolutely tortured to watch the president of Russia go on about this so-called special military operation. So I'm not sure who blinks first. I think at this point, it doesn't look like anyone is really inclined to do so. The Ukrainians, because they're fighting for their territorial integrity and for their country, and the Russians, because they're being taken for a ride by a president with really bizarre fantasies of sort of return to glories of lost empire.
And we'll leave it there. Simon Miles is an assistant professor in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University and author of Engaging the Evil Empire. It's a book about back-channel communications that facilitated the beginning of the end of the Cold War. Professor Miles, thanks for being with us today. Thanks for your analysis.
Thanks for having me.
Over the past year of war, Russia has occupied and lost vast swaths of Ukraine, and it now appears to be attempting to retake some of the same territory. Families remaining in areas under fire say the losses they have already suffered have been enormous. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from the Kherson Oblast.
When it was occupied by Russia last year, this village, Pravdina, in the Kherson Oblast, was surrounded by the Ukrainian army and engaged in fierce fighting.
This is the airport just outside the city of Kherson. The level of destruction here is breathtaking.
Each side has attacked the airport multiple times. Both would rather see it in ruins than be useful to the enemy. Inside this provincial capital, street signs declare Kherson a hero city and say, "Family, you are free." Bombs still fall day and night, but most of the city still stands. Locals say the vast majority of residents fled long ago. Some escaped when Russia took over. Others left with the Russians when Ukraine took the city back. Russian forces are only a few kilometers away, and the people remaining say they have nowhere to go, or they have been displaced from even more dangerous places.
And after a full year of war here in Ukraine, locals say that even if it ends tomorrow, the devastation here is enormous. Reporting from Kherson in Ukraine, Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, DC.